What is crack-a-lackin', fellow thermonuclear AFers? I am Dan Valley, coming at you with part one of a two-part mailbag. It's definitely going to be two parts because I am freaking struggling to stay awake right now. So I'm going to try and limit myself to 40 to 45 minutes, get to as many of your questions as possible. Going to start with the Discord members. That's why you should join our Discord. You should also just subscribe to us wherever you get us. That helps us out a lot. YouTube, like, comment on every single video, even if you're, you know, consuming us via audio. That helps the algorithm love us back. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, leave ratings and reviews on Apple. That can help us out a ton as well if you haven't done so already. If you've done all those things, subscribe across all three of the major platforms. Consider telling people about us, retweeting our promo, shouting us out on Twitter, anything to help continue to get the good word of Hardwood Knox out there. Join our Discord. Like I said already, you're going to get priority mailbag access, as well as we have a ton of great discussions in there. And finally, if you're looking for another way to support the show, we have merch now. I am rocking. I'll try and remember to rock stuff on every podcast. If you can see, I'm wearing the Hardwood Knox hoodie, and I was just talking away from the mic, so hopefully anyone might have heard that. So the link to that is in the podcast and YouTube descriptions as well. And the website will give you, you could do stickers, mugs, the whole nine. So get yourself and your family members and your acquaintances some Hardwood Knox swag. Let's dive into this, though. And I should also pull open the thing that's going to let me timestamp this as best as possible, which is always a challenge when doing the solo podcast, when I kind of have to vamp before we even get to a question. So this first one comes from Muckle. And it's not really a question, less of a question and more of a rant, and not even an original one. Why does ESPN broadcast NBA games? Mike Breen is a pro, but Mark Jones and JVG don't even sound like they enjoy the NBA at times. I can't think of a single talking head I want to hear the opinion of. Halftime gets muted or I do something else. Contrast that with TNT coverage that is at least entertaining and usually informative. The difference is just so stark. I can certainly sense that. And look, Turner, Warner Media, whatever TNT is under at this point, is my parent company, a full-time employee of Bleacher Report. So I'm not going to come on here and trash them. For as much crap as the announcers across the board get, though, I will say that it does seem like the TNT folks generally embrace the game more and seem happy about covering it. And even Reggie Miller the other night, and Holly McKenzie had pointed this out on Twitter, it was when the Celtics got blown out in game three. Reggie Miller, he receives a lot of crap. But I think I don't have like really strong feelings about any of the announcers. Some I love, some I'm indifferent to. I get like the JVG Mark Jackson stuff, but I'm just someone who doesn't let that impact me as much, I guess. And that's not to say it operates on a higher level. I get if you want a certain type of color commentating specifically, you're going to be, I definitely have my preferred broadcast teams or color analysts for sure. And even play by play people as well, but it's just not, you know, it doesn't really make me angry when it's bad. I find it more funny. And I understand that some people don't. And I think that's perfectly fine. But Reggie Miller is someone who really embraces the game. But then you can sense this tonal shift when the Celtics are getting just absolutely rip-rolled against Boston in game three. It was just really funny because if you're disgusting Reggie Miller, you've done something wrong because he seems to genuinely appreciate the contemporary game. What I will say, and this is only tangentially related to what Muckle is saying. Look, ESPN is going to continue to broadcast games. They're the biggest league partner that the NBA has right now. And that's going to continue into the next TV deal, I would assume. And so like they're going to broadcast games. They could get more creative with their teams. I mean, like Doris Burke and Hubie Brown are just way better, way more entertaining, or seem like they like, well, I'm going to say way better, way more entertaining than the duo of JVG and Mark Jackson, who, yeah, they're good for some laughs. But if you're looking for a thorough basketball experience, Doris Burke, Hubie Brown, JJ Redick, of course. I love the JJ Redick and Richard Jefferson tandem, who I think it was used like kind of sparingly throughout the regular season, or at least I wasn't catching those nationally televised games as much. And I caught a few during the playoffs, I think two of them, and they were in consecutive. I don't even remember what series, and maybe that's like not really a ringing endorsement of how well they are, but I super enjoyed those. So I'm more the halftime shows and the pregame shows for ESPN would run me the wrong way more. I understand that you got to get, you got to feed the machine financially, and that entails a lot of ads, but there's just no depth to those discussions. They feel rushed. They feel not scripted, but overly planned, but without any substance, and you're not really tackling these real issues. And the fact that there's been so much churn in those shows, just a little bit disappointing, because at least with however you feel about Inside the NBA, people criticize those guys all the time. The continuity, the chemistry between them is palpable, and the way it's set up because of, the network, also the money that's invested into these shows, you get more of a feel for them, and you're not rushing because it's not the worldwide leader. You're not rushing to the next thing, even post game. Like, you have an opportunity. Halftime, it's always going to be abbreviated, but even Kenny Smith go up and do his screen like breakdowns of what happened in the first half. And so I get why people prefer. I get why people have issues with all the broadcasts. I get why people most certainly seem to prefer TNT to the ESPN experience, though. It is way more relatable, in depth, and there's just more time there. And that is to some degree by design. And I don't know how ESPN necessarily fixes that, because you're not going to get rid of ads. Can you bleed over into what you want other broadcasts to be rather than going directly to SportsCenter after these games? Maybe something to consider. But like the Tim Legler segments with Scott Van Pelt are like some of the best basketball analysis you're going to get. So it's a complicated issue. I will say, I will always make jokes on Twitter about this. So I am 100% a hypocrite. And I want to make that abundantly clear here. The complaining of the coverage is just when it's actually damaging and like bad, bordering on toxic, when someone says something, writes something that's just totally not okay and warrants this incensed response. Yes, those are issues. But like, now we're just looking for reasons, it feels like, a lot of the time, to complain. Or there's like this, the two things that stood out. So I put this in our Discord. People are already complaining about a lack of finals coverage. Now, if you think the Nuggets have been undercovered all year, underappreciated all year, that is one thing. We can have that conversation. They don't have an opponent yet. We can't have too much finals coverage when they don't have an opponent. So, and again, whatever you think about the authenticity behind this, we have a few questions on the Lakers. No worse than the second greatest player of all time just hinted at retirement. That is going to be a storyline, especially when, yeah, there's a series going on. It's Boston and Miami. There's only so much you can talk about that. And I don't think some people, I'm not looping, it doesn't have to be you need to be in the business to understand this. People in Discord, I had like anyone who's a basketball fan, I think, is capable of understanding this, or if they put thought into it, understands this. And it's clear that our Discord members understand it. I'm sure that of the thousands of people that listen to this podcast, all of you, 90% of you understand this. You're shrinking your audience so much if you go down to one playoff series. There's only so much Heat versus Celtics content that Knicks fans want to hear, as an example, as Hornets fans want to hear. And if we're at a point in the season where 27 other teams right now, there are news cycles for them, coaching vacancies and interviews, and then the draft and free agency, I understand the issue with people saying that outlets, including my own, are geared too far towards that during the middle of the season when it's not as topical. Right now, free agency and the draft are like a month away each, a little bit over a month away for free agency. That is topical. And there are 27 other team news cycles to talk about. And so don't complain because that there's not enough, finals content or even Nuggets content right now on the front page of ESPN and Bleacher Report. There should be a lead up to it. Let's see what Denver content, Nuggets content there is when we have a finals matchup. I fully understand that the NBA does, the complaining about TV ratings for a prospective Miami-Denver series, the jokes are funny. I've made them myself. But if I would side with the people who are going to have an issue with this. If we can't figure out a way, and Jared Dubin said this on Twitter, if the league can't figure out a way to market a back-to-back MVP winner on what was the best team in the Western Conference, going up against a seventh best record, but eighth seed that kind of came out of nowhere in the Eastern Conference, despite making the conference finals a year ago, and has one of the greatest playoff performers, quite frankly, of all time at this point, in Jimmy Butler. Yeah, that's a fundamental failure. And there are definitely things that need to change here. But I also think, by and large, the people who are complaining don't understand how little of a sway that content creators and even these companies have over shaping the shape and form of the content. I can tell you firsthand that if I'm going to write a piece on even a single team that's not the Lakers or, let's say, the Warriors, maybe even the Knicks, that traffic, that piece is going to do terrible. Some of our least downloaded podcasts, and I do them, I don't want to say out of obligation. We have real sickos that listen to this podcast, and I love every single one of you. And some of you won't download or listen to everyone. When I do the look aheads every offseason, where I do a deep dive, normally between 45 minutes and 90 minutes on each team, those are the least downloaded podcasts that we have. And I do those because I enjoy them. I think that they're instructive for me as I'm leading into the season as well. When you shrink down to these more nuanced singular topics, you're restricting your audience, because there's going to be just general NBA fans, fans of other teams, or more casual fans, which, hey, casual shouldn't be a dirty word. You have to cater to those people. And now you can argue that, well, then the way the business model is set up is kind of fucked. And I would agree with you there. The fact that you X's and O's breakdowns are going to do no matter what time of year, an X's and O's breakdown, I don't even care who it is. I don't care who it is not going to do as much traffic as a trades piece, as a response to an actual rumor. People like the hypothetical, or they like what's more incendiary, and there could be a fundamental failure of, well, why are they consuming the sport like this? And I would agree to some extent, but when we are so quick to compare, look at how good the NFL is, for instance, at getting their fans to be involved in the games and the storyline surrounding specific games and teams, rather than just, oh, who's going to go where in free agency and trades. I get that, but the NFL is a lot more time to break all these more granular, nuanced things down. There are fewer games, so there's a scarcity of product, which I also think contributes to why it's also so popular. And you also have more time in between plays. So, like, it's not just the games where, you know, you have, let's say, 5-6 days, whatever, in between each game, and sometimes longer, but you're able to, in between plays, really go over it. And when you're listening to an NBA broadcast, even the best of the best, it sometimes feels like they need to rush their words. And if you're not familiar with the vernacular, it could be harder to keep up. That's just the nature of the game being so fast-paced. You're not even going to have as much time as you do in between pitches, even now with the pitch clock in MLB. I would also argue, and this is the NHL. Like, that's, for me, that's really tough to follow when you're going to start talking about the X's and O's and the more nuanced topics of that. I think the pace of play for those sports does make it harder to market it the way that some people insist that it needs to be. And there are people that are doing fantastic work on a more granular level that figure out a way to draw in huge audiences. And I think, you know, Zach Lowe does a good job with his pieces, but really the dunker spot with Steve Jones and Nekias Duncan is sort of the hallmark it's a wide audience. They're not just covering one team. They're covering the entire league, also the WNBA. And they get into the minutiae of everything that's happening on the court. And because they're able to cast such a wide net in their episodes, I would argue that they probably have a monstrous audience, which, good for them. They do fantastic work. It's going to be harder. And even JJ Redick, with his interviews and with his access, that's going to help to be where he is. He's doing deeper dive breakdowns, especially when you look at, I'm not the biggest fan of player podcasts, not because I'm threatened by that business model, but just I find a lot of the analysis and conversations more performative or surface level. But like JJ Redick's podcast, that's going to be super in-depth. And so, like, yes, there is clearly a market for these things, but there's a market for everything. And I do think that even there are people who are genuinely trying to either push to write or create more content that is more specific, that is, in theory, more topical, like an NBA Finals or a deep dive into the Nuggets, but you're not going to get it. And it's not even the people. You can't even blame the editors or who's ever, like, in charge of content. It's ultimately, like, everything is going to be about the bottom line at the end of the day. And that's going to contribute to how skewed the coverage is. I'm not saying that it's incapable of changing, but there's going to need to be real concession in places that are not front-facing when it comes to the content creation and production. And I find it bizarre at this point that there's, like, this kink for, hey, let's listen to JJ Redick call out his own coworkers, basically, about how poor or lopsided coverage is geared towards teams. And that's, you can tweet about it. You could quote tweet the clip, get your engagements, your retweets, your likes. That's fine. What is this changing? Those segments where someone, because it's not just him that's done it, where someone is talking about how undercover the Nuggets are on this very network, what has that actually changed? Is the next segment not going to be about LeBron's retirement or something? And so I find that to be just, I watch it. Like, it's, I guess it makes for good television, but it's also kind of an extension of this engagement fodder where your companies can create their own news cycle. Because, one of our employees is kind of calling us out for the way that we create content, and we're just going to continue to do it the same way. That's how we're going to discuss it, but we're going to let them go and that clip will go viral. I find that to be, like, a very weird engagement kink, too. And the other thing I'll say is the best way to get more of the content, if you want, X's and O's content, if you want more Nuggets content, if you want more Charlotte Hornets content, if you want more Washington Wizards content, which we actually have a Washington Wizards news note to get to in a second. And I was on a Washington Wizards podcast, the Believe in Wizards podcast with Matt Moderno. Go check that out. Digressing there very quickly. Consume that content. This is, I'm not lecturing people who are listening to this podcast, but when you're going to look at the numbers, like, don't give it the performative retweet or like or quote tweet. Actually read it and consume it, quote it, like really consume it. And so if people are going to complain about that, I want to know how many of them are actually consuming the deeper dive content that's out there. Whereas we're at a point where I think even a lot of higher level basketball analysts, podcasters, bloggers, writers, journalists, whatever, it seems like they hate listen or hate watch some of these things at this point. If it's not your cup of tea, move on. There are those alternatives out there, one of them being the dunker spot, like nationally. And so if you think there's a dearth of it on a national level, I'm totally here for that too. I think there's a bunch of different podcasts when you look across all the different networks, all the different talent, not just with teams, but nationally, that you can find what actually interests you or caters to your coverage preferences. And you can curate your timeline on social media, on your podcast feed in that vein. And you don't need to, I guess you're forced to sit through broadcasts that you're not happy with. And so, yeah, if there's something happening on the ESPN halftime show that's, you know, Stephen A. Smith suggesting that Anthony Davis chose to be injured that one game against the, is that the first round series? I think it was in the first round, but whatever. Like, yeah, I get that that's going to incite reactions. I'm kind of over the actual, let's get angry about this. And then let's just share clips of other people who are talking about how angry they are about this when it's not actually inciting change. That's not that I feel like maybe that comes off as, well, we should just give up at this point. But I find, just like there's the subset of consumption where it's, oh, we're going to hate listen to Bill Simmons, or we're going to hate listen to even Zach Lowe, I feel like gets it at this point. We're going to hate listen to the Hoop Collective so that we can dunk on Dave McMenamin for saying, are the Lakers really going to lose to Denver? And yeah, that's a, you know, wow, that's rough stuff there. I don't disagree with that. Like, you're not forced to, there are alternatives out there. We act like you're very, that I feel like sometimes a lot of people, and I'm not trying to paint with a super broad brush here, act like this is the only thing, like you're only, that you can't curate your content based on your actual preferences. And I actually do believe that you can. Now, when you're looking at the more broad-based national stuff where it is these networks, I understand that there are real discussions to be had. I just don't understand where it's like there's almost this, as I was kind of saying before I got away from it, this subset of, we want to complain about the way that the NBA is covered. And I don't know what that complaining is actually going to come. Call out actually toxic takes, please, and share whatever you like, to each their own. I just can't bring myself to get actively hostile over it. And then, you know, as someone working at a sports media company that just survived another round, or went through, excuse me, survived. Wow, that's a terrible phrasing. Went through another round of layoffs, and you see people that you've worked with for years and become close with be reassigned or lose their jobs entirely. You know what? Like, you need to pump out the LeBron James content. Go right ahead if that's going to keep some good people employed. I want it to change, but there needs to be an actual commitment to it. And I think we've even seen some outlets commit to it only to kind of double back once they don't have the stomach for it. With certain shows, like writers, it's like this weird cycle, and it's not to give up. I think that the WNBA specifically, I feel like, I don't want to use the word outlets have taken a chance, but when outlets have invested in WNBA coverage, it does feel like it's generally panned out, where it's, you know, Bleacher Report Social is going to put out a lot of WNBA, and I'm not trying to dislocate my shoulder patting my employer on the back, but like even ESPN, like investing more in WNBA coverage, or even at least some social media exposure. And then, yeah, like you want to dunk on the quote unquote interns running the social accounts, which, hey, geniuses, they're not interns running these massive accounts with millions of followers. I'm going to tell you that right now. You can dunk on the tweets that are just bad looks. We did one on the other podcast the other day when it was whose jersey should be retired for number 15 in Denver, Jokic or Melo. Like, there are, of course, always going to be instances like that, but you're going to get mad because there's a, I think it was an ESPN NBA tweet or a SportsCenter tweet. I think it might have been an ESPN NBA tweet. So geared towards NBA coverage, throwing out an engagement tweet. It was the screenshot of Jordan Clarkson in his fight stand saying, what NBA opinion are you going to defend like this? There's actually nothing wrong with that. And it's also, that shit works. And until that shit doesn't work, or until you figure out a way to get people to not just, like, view this content as, oh, I consumed it, it's a bad badge of honor, but to actively engage with it more, I don't know what the answer is. I don't pretend to have the solution. I just find it really weird that it feels like there's this, again, engagement kink of let's complain about this or celebrate people who are complaining about it, and no actual change is coming about. And there needs to be decision makers in charge who are going to commit to the change. I don't pretend to have all the answers here, and I guess this is me sort of complaining about it, but there's the discussion needs to be, and it probably shouldn't be one that I'm having just against myself. It's so much more nuanced, and there are layers to it. And there are, I think, are not arguments of both sides, but there needs to be like a deeper discussion and probably more thought placed into, okay, well, if we're going to, here's my thing. If you're going to really complain about this, map out what you would do differently then. And I hope this podcast, I think sometimes networks and podcasts might be trying to be too many things to too many different people. We really try to cast a wide net here. Like, we're not going to give you the super deep high level X's and O's breakdowns, but we are going to try and get into thorough aspects of the game and players and teams. We're also going to try and be a little funny, and we're going to cover the trades and the free agency stuff and the rumors and do draft reactions. That content is going to be put out. And it's some of the content that I enjoy the most. It's also, you know what? Our trade content, if I put that out right now, if I came up with a hypothetical trade podcast, that's going to do so many more downloads than this episode or the episode that Grant and I just did. It's just, it's a matter of fact. And our best performance time of the year is around the trade deadline and then around free agency and the draft. That's our best time of year. And then I guess in the dead of the off season, because we do produce more content here usually than a lot of other podcasts. And that's a struggle that national podcast specifically is definitely a struggle for team podcasts when you're sort of the dead of the off season and you only have the one team to focus on if there's not this huge news cycle. But that's all year nationally, there's probably the push and pull to, well, we need to do what's going to draw the most engagement or the most eyeballs or the most downloads or the most views, because that's still the way that these things are measured. Even if they're measured in time spent in the app or on an article or video, keeping people engaged at the end of the day is still, even if it's hate engagement, even if it's drawing their ire, that is still such a huge part of the business model. And I just can't, I get that it's repetitive and it can be annoying, and that having to be forced to tune into games where you're getting the super surface level analysis bordering on, it seems like they hate the game and you can't understand that. I totally empathize with that, whatever. But I also kind of understand it from the people who are actually in the content creation game, who are not like these millionaires who have the type of influence to change the way that things are covered. I understand why things are geared towards this way, and I don't have an answer to change it. And I feel like maybe we all need to be more upfront about it. And that's not to say follow my lead here. I don't have answers for how to change it. It has boggled my mind at some of the people that have been let go at places where they're doing great work, or even some of the outlets that we've seen over the course, or some of the independent podcasts we've seen sort of just shudder, even though they're just wildly talented and providing such great information and content. And so I don't have an answer, and that really sucks. And I need to do a better job of acknowledging we don't have an answer to things in general. But on this topic specifically, I think we can all just admit, well, we don't really know what the answer is here. And that was a way longer rant than I intended. So let's just move on. I think it's just really, it's going to touch a nerve a little bit more because of what just happened at Warner Media. And again, it hasn't directly impacted me, so to speak. It's impacted how I work for sure. My workflow and all that, but to go through that again, like the third time since Thanksgiving, or the second time since Thanksgiving, that probably seeing some of this stuff has probably touched a nerve more than it normally would. So there's my little content creation / lead coverage rant. We can get to some more just actual like basketball stuff, which hey, this is not a question, although I did go, like I said, on the Believe in Wizards podcast to talk about the team hiring general manager of the Clippers, Michael Winger, to be their new president. And I talked with Matt Moderno about this, so I don't want to belabor too much. Go check out that podcast. I will say I tend not to get too excited about Wizards moves, but this feels like a home run. He is someone who spent time in the Cleveland front office during that first LeBron go around. I think he started there in 2005, if I'm not mistaken. Then he was with the Thunder under Sam Presti. And then he's been a part of, for a while now, the Clippers organization, which is widely viewed, that front office, as one of the most creative and aggressive in the league. You're not going to have Steve Ballmer's wallet. You have Ted Leonsis now. And it's not like they have all of a sudden all these assets in Washington that they didn't have before. Woj touted winger as a relationship builder. Free agency just doesn't really matter as much anymore, let alone in Washington. But he is a deal maker. That's something else Woj just said. And the teams that he's been involved with, specifically the Clippers, like, yeah, they've been deal makers. And they figured out how to get stuff done even when they've been hamstrung, like a Norman Powell trade. Or they've been able to find some hidden gems, so to speak, where it's like, oh, Brandon Boston Jr. might turn into something. Or Amir Coffey, Terrence Mann, Nick Batum. Like, yeah, that comes via buyout. It helps that you're in L.A. Even Reggie Jackson, though, there was the renaissance there for a while. I think this is a good hire by the Wizards because this is someone who I would think had options and was probably offered head lead front office gigs in the past and either turned them down or at least he made it to the final rounds of them. And would he, Woj reported it as full leadership in Washington. I don't really know what that means. That's not the equivalent of autonomy. It's just a bizarre way to phrase it. You would hope, though, that there'll be some semblance of autonomy because why would he leave the Clippers otherwise? I would say at least a relatively comfy gig, or maybe it's getting uncomfortable because of all the time that Kawhi Leonard and Paul George have missed and relative to expectations since that trade, you have underachieved. But now you're coming to an organization that is under Ted Leonsis has been just addicted to the bottom of the middle. I don't know why you would accept that job without the promise. And we have to really see what his intro presser is like, but without the promise of some level of autonomy. And maybe that's a matter of, okay, you need to figure out how to re-sign Kuzma and Kristaps, and we're mostly going to run it back. But if things aren't working out by the trade deadline, you will have the power, the influence to tear it down. We could also just look at the moves that they make this offseason as a harbinger of how much power Winger actually has, where it's, does he get to build out his staff? What do they do around the draft? What do the contracts of KP and Kuzma look like? What happens to some of the incumbent players, specifically the younger ones who are not Winger's guys, where I love Denny Avdia, but he's extension eligible. Do you look at moving him or do you just punt on signing him to an extension? Do you look at moving Johnny Davis or Corey Kispert? I think there will be breadcrumbs, even if it's not major moves. And I would bet that something in Washington happens. But even if it's, I talked about this with Matt, if it's moving Daniel Gafford or Monte Morris, you've already paid Bradley Beal. You have DeLon Wright. You're going to look for an upgraded point guard anyway. So you move on from Monte Morris with him entering the final year of his deal, or you move on from Daniel Gafford because you're about to re-sign Kristaps Porzingis and the dual big stuff. It did not work defensively. It actually worked out fairly well offensively for them. And I think there will be hints, breadcrumbs, even if there's no major move that tells you how much power he actually has. And I think it's just a good sign for now. We'll see if said to me on Twitter that Ted Leonsis is going to burst in like the Kool-Aid man to ruin the good vibes. That could very well still happen, but I really do like this hire from the Wizards. And the other thing I believe it would show is that they're willing to invest in the front office. I don't think that this is a person that you hire without having to sort of back up the Brinks truck a little bit, just because he has been linked to so many other jobs. And again, I keep coming back to the title, where it's, I know there was some weird phrasing that he was hired as the new president and the general manager. I think that was per the Washington Post. Whether he gets to hire a general manager to work under him or not, the fact that president is in the title, I know these titles are largely whatever. They could be czar of basketball operations for all I care. But I view that as encouraging if I'm Wizards fans. And so that's where I'm at on this hire, insofar as you can get just stoked about a lead executive hire. This is not Masai Ujiri. It's not even Tim Connolly, although, we can have a different conversation about that. It's not Bob Myers, who, him being linked to any other team was always weird because it's always seemed like, and the reporting from The Athletic has suggested that if he leaves, it's really not because of money. It doesn't seem like, or it does seem, I think Shams did report that they were far apart in negotiations, so maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like maybe someone who would just want to take a beat, and so you weren't going to latch on to a team like the Wizards anyway. So I think this was probably of the names that were mentioned. I know it came down to, I don't know that they could have went wrong with the final two names between Trajan Langdon and Michael Winger. I like what they did though. And I think it's, this is what I said on the Believe in Wizards. Go check it out. We talked for like 45 minutes, but I'll finally say you can't give the Wizards the benefit of the doubt, but I would be cautiously optimistic about what this says about what they're willing to do moving forward. And even if it's just a matter of taking a huge swing where it's okay, Tommy Shepard won a lot of the trades he made, more of the recent trades. No, not the Rui Hachimura one, but he won the second Russell Westbrook trade. He definitely won the, What am I blanking on? What was the other big trade? He won the Russell Westbrook trade. He won that Kristaps Porzingis trade, even though Spencer Dinwiddie went on to play well in Dallas. Like, yeah, you signed Spencer Dinwiddie that contract in the first place, but they were doubles. This is maybe this shows that now they put someone in place who was in a front office that swung for triples and home runs. And even if you bring that mentality, okay, they're not going to strip it down and start over like a lot of fans want them to, but are they really going to go out there and be like, hey, like we'll attach some language where it says first allowable first round pick after that 2000. And now it defers to 2024 for the Knicks. We'll send out extra first round picks in addition to number 8 this year to go out and get the guy or a bigger name guy. And so I liked that move by the Wizards. How's this for a mailbag where we're 30 minutes in and I've answered one question that was actually asked and it wasn't even a question. We are going to get to another question though, going through Discord here, and Moose Machine, I'll answer this one quickly because we did touch on it on the last podcast. I hope that you were able to check that one out. Thoughts on the final candidates for the Bucks? Who's the best fit? Who would you hire for that team? So we're down to Adrian Griffin, Nick Nurse, and Kenny Atkinson, I believe are the names that were mentioned for them. I went with Kenny Atkinson and Grant went with Nick Nurse. I don't know that there's a wrong answer here. I think that Adrian Griffin's experience in Toronto is probably that ends up being a really big deal. And knowing that he's been under, he was an assistant on the championship winning coaching staff. Like that's something that you bring to the table there, that experience. So it's okay. It's someone who doesn't have this extensive head coaching resume, but he's under these coaching staffs that have won at the highest level. And so I would be fairly surprised if they go that route just because it is a first time head coach. Maybe does he have, ties to people in the organization? Is it someone that Giannis really likes and respect? There are all those things to mention. I prefer Kenny Atkinson. I know people think he's more of sort of this groomer of young talent. That's really largely based on the timing of his arrival to Brooklyn Nets and then his departure, whereas they get these superstars and then he's dismissed. He wasn't given a chance there. And so I think he's someone that could work with bigger names, especially if they're willing to be coach or aren't trying to oust him from day one. And so he would be my pick, but I get the appeal of Nick Nurse, who's just viewed as this maniacal tactician. I just think he kind of needs more depth at his disposal than we credit. And I'm not, or anticipate or acknowledge, and I don't know that the Bucks actually have that. And I will say the Raptors are known to have great talent at like spots at their top five players, whatever, top four players, top five, top six players, and they were not a great team this year. And so some of that has to at least fall on Nurse. Did he not have enough shooting? How much say did he have in the vision of how the roster was built? That's all fair. I think that he might be the obvious choice just because of like what he did in Toronto during his first season there. He had Kawhi Leonard though. And like, that's something that's certainly worth mentioning. Next question comes from Drizzy Watts. I know it's the negative Sixers fan in me, but given the result of the past season and the clear ceiling we have is currently constructed, would it be a step too far to explore a trade for Joel Embiid? Maybe the number 3 pick and Shaedon Sharpe as the starting point, and then try a different build with Maxi, Sharpe, and maybe take one of the Thompson twins or even Brandon Miller if he's there at number 3. # return of the process. I respect you as a Philly fan having the stomach for that. I want to make that clear. I wouldn't go that route. If James Harden's willing to come back and you can run it back with him and Joel Embiid, is there something that you can get with the one first round pick you could trade plus Tobias Harris that noticeably upgrades your roster, gives you some more bench depth? I think they were closer than maybe people think now in hindsight. They were up 3-2 on the Celtics. Whatever you think of the Celtics, they were one of the best teams in the league at this point. And that implies that they're close. Now, James Harden's getting older. Even Joel Embiid's getting older. Will he ever have a season where he plays this much during the regular season again? He always seems to break down or have a nagging serious injury in the playoffs. James Harden's playoff resume is topsy-turvy. And so I totally get all that. I couldn't, even if they have a 3% chance or whatever it is of winning the title, I just can't punt on that because of how hard it is to really get to that level, whether you're talking about a league that is very top heavy or one right now where there's this overwhelming amount of parity. Having actual title chances is a big deal. And I would look at more moves to improve on the margins, deep in the rotation on the margins. I get what you're saying though. And if that's something that you could do, I mean, Joel Embiid is age 29. It'll be his age 29 season next year. If I'm not mistaken, I'll double check that. And given his injury history, I'd be curious to see what your, yeah, he turned 29 on March 16th. I'd be curious to see what you could get for him. That's, and look, that's certainly a really good starting point. If you have Sharp and the number three pick to go along with Maxey, who still has another year on his rookie scale, you're in great shape. You do have, I don't know how much this complicates that, but you do have those picks owed to Philly and Brooklyn when you're looking to rebuild. The 2025 first to OKC is top six protected and then top four for 2 years. So that goes through 2027. And then Brooklyn, there's going to be that top eight protected pick that I think goes to it. It's top eight protected in 2027, but it leaks into 2028 and then it just expires. It becomes a second round pick. So, like that, the fact that you don't necessarily control the fate of your own first round pick, from between 2025 and like you're going to still wind up with picks, but there's a chance that you don't control the fate of your own picks then if you're looking to rebuild because they are protected during that window. Does that diminish the likelihood that this team has the stomach for an actual rebuild? I don't. So I think the best way to frame it is even though I wouldn't do it, I don't think it's actually a step too far. If you wanted to turn around and say, hey, let's rebuild because you think that James Harden's going to leave or doesn't want to be here, or you don't want to invest, $40 million a year plus $1 million a year in James Harden moving forward, and you don't want to foot the bill for Joel Embiid's next contract where he has 2 years left before he's eligible to become a free agent. It's a $58.2 million player option in 27, 28. You're kind of looking at this as, is our window really longer than 2 years? Like he's going to be entering in his 30s and how he's going to hold up as he gets older. I do not think it's a step too far to consider it. Would I consider it at this point? If James Harden doesn't want to come back, I probably would not. Do I think the Sixers would consider it? Absolutely not. I think they would be more bullish on themselves than either of us. But I don't think that's the negative Sixers fan in you, Drizzy Watts. I want to make that clear. I actually think that that's a very reasonable way to look at this. Our next question comes from Christopher asking, ooh, this is a good one. With LeBron mentioning the possibility of retirement in parentheticals, I doubt he does. How would that affect his contract with the team? Do the Lakers still need to pay him, or does that negate the contract and his salaries off LA's books? And look, I will say, if a player retires and they file the paperwork with the league, it should just count as coming off the books. I do not believe it's that simple, though. I think the cleanest way to do it is they broker a buyout with LeBron, and then they keep that dead money on their books for the year, which would be, in theory, you would broker the buyout of, okay, $1.7 million, like just something stupid where he's still getting a payout, but it negligibly impacts your cap and you move forward. But there were some people floating the idea of like maybe you just pay him for the years, showing that you take care of players even though he is retired. I mean, look, what he won a championship for the franchise, and I guess he would still like he helped with the brand. I might cross the line where it's let LeBron take the year, like pay him for a full year before you go that route. But it's not as simple as it just negates the contract if he retires, and so that really is an issue throughout all this. It's not like the Lakers would have immediate cap space or flexibility if he announces his retirement. It could go that route. And again, there's a very easy path to do it. And I would assume if he's going to retire, he'd be agreeable to it just because you could get, yeah, it might delay their season. But if he's like refusing to file paperwork or they're trying to not pay him on the grounds that he wasn't an active member of the team and it requires litigation and all this stuff, it could drag out and ruin next season. But at the end of the day, like, the Lakers are going to win that grievance. But I will say, so in short, no, the Lakers don't just have to pay him if he retires. But unless there's some quick resolution for his departure, it's not as easy as, oh, LeBron retired. Like that money just is off the Lakers books. And I'm with you. I'd be shocked if he retires. And we did use the marathon analogy, 20 consecutive marathon analogy to describe him hinting at retirement in the previous podcast. So go check that episode out for a little bit more on LeBron's retirement. Although I think we have another question or two on this. Pito, you asked a bunch of questions, so I will try and answer a few as we go about this, but we'll just see how many I can get to. First one, considering Monty's firing, is it possible the Suns keep DeAndre Ayton? Maybe. if only because there's not a market for him. He's got 3 years and a little bit over $100 million left on his deal. And I think they can talk themselves into, if you go through a whole training camp and the spacing is pristine next year and Chris Paul is still there and healthy, like he's going to still be able to feast and he will play better defensively than he did this year. I would be, and I think if he's on the Suns, I think it's almost a bad omen for his market value. And I proposed DeAndre Ayton for Miles Turner straight up. And that was not only rejected. It wasn't, I'm not saying that I would have done it, to be clear, but like, let's just revisit the team last year. That's not under the offer sheet. I don't think the Pacers, Grant said this, multiple people in my DM said it. They don't think that the Pacers would do that at this point. And so what are you hoping to get for him? Is it send him to Dallas for stuff if Kyrie leaves, or even if Kyrie Irving doesn't leave because they're so desperate for a center and they think they could rehabilitate his defensive upside? He's just so inconsistent, particularly on the offensive end. I don't know that there's going to be this robust market for him. And so if they can move him and it's not like this net negative deal, because they can't attach sweeteners to him. Like, that ship has sailed after the Kevin Durant trade. If it's not a matter of taking back a bad contract, I think they'd fall short of a straight salary dump too. I mean, they might be enticed by someone who has a expiring deal that maybe they don't necessarily need long term. They could go that route. If he's still on the Suns, I think that that's probably less a vote of confidence in DeAndre Ayton's value and future to them, and more an indictment on the trade market or lack thereof for him. Another question from Pito asks, this one is more fantasy style. What are your thoughts about the idea of Bobby Portis on the Pelicans? This year we saw them closing games without a center. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I'd be curious to see what a package looks like in that scenario for Bobby Portis with the Pelicans. And I think while he would definitely space the floor around Zion, and he holds up better defensively on switches than I think most people think, you need more of this tried and true rim protector, I would say, alongside Zion as the big man. Look, offensively, it could just work. I just don't know if on the Pelicans how much value they will. I think I'd rather close with Larry Nance Jr. personally over Bobby Portis, just because of the defensive versatility. And then you just get into the matching money issues. It's really, are you trading Larry Nance for Bobby Portis, or are you trading Jonas Valanciunas to Milwaukee? And why is Milwaukee interested in Jonas Valanciunas? Is it because Brooke Lopez is leaving? And hey, if Brooke Lopez is leaving, why aren't the Pelicans trying to get involved in that as a sign and trade option, even though they're very close to the tax? I would figure out a way to work it under the hard cap if it meant pairing Zion with Brooke Lopez. So offensively, sure. Like, he's going to give you more volume from three than Larry Nance, more volume from three than Jonas Valanciunas. He can also sort of, his creation is different than Jonas's, who's going to be more like physical and I don't want to say ground and pound, because he has some outside in stuff. But like, Bobby Portis has way more of that, where he could pump and really operate more quickly off the dribble. We've seen him hit some, you know, where Jonas Valanciunas can maybe have some more physical finishes. We've seen Bobby Portis hit like just ridiculously tough fadeaways and some of them off the dribble. So I like the offensive fit. I just have so many questions about it defensively. And I think Pito has some other ones that we might be able to get to here, but let's get to this next one from Real Syrup 2219. Is this LeBron retirement topic just another example of LeBron manipulating the media? He throws that out as post-game presser and everyone is talking about that instead of Lakers getting swept. That is, look, we talked about this on the podcast too, but I didn't frame it like from this perspective. I like this. I hope that's what it is, because you had Brian Windhorst was on his podcast talking about how LeBron had like the most iconic performance in a sweep ever. And I feel like that response might've been trolled a little bit more than it was if we weren't dealing with the LeBron retirement stuff. I like the idea that he would do this. I also thought it was, could it be a scare tactic? Is he trying to apply pressures to the Lakers that, hey, we can't stand pat, or you can't just re-sign all these guys who are free agents and have us run it back? I joked that it was him taking attention away from Carmelo Anthony. And then I also, the conversation Grant and I had was basically he ran 20 consecutive seasons playing specifically over the last 18 years. How many on average games a season does LeBron play? Like, I guess he's missed time, but like, it's a long, you know, nine months for him or whatever. And immediately after the 20th time of doing this, he's asked about figuring out his future. And so I think it's only natural that he might be more contemplative, ambiguous, cryptic, bordering on final with his thoughts. I hope though, Real Syrup, I hope that the answer is okay, he's trying to screw with the media and just make sure that we're not talking as much about the sweep, which, look, we're not. We're definitely talking about their future, but we focused on his retirement. Pito's question on this topic is, I got another one on LeBron. I'm personally excluding the option of him retiring, but with him needing surgery this summer, I imagine he would need a lot of time to get back. Does this situation end the AD LBJ era in LA with LBJ and AD contracts ending pretty soon? No. I mean, like, how does it, what do we mean by end in LA? Because if we assume LeBron is back, do we think that his foot surgery is going to take him all season? And I think that he has a $50 million player option for 24-25. Maybe he opts out and leaves, tried to play with, I think that'd be Bronny's first year. He did mention, though, while it might be his dream to play with Bronny, that doesn't mean that that's what Bronny wants, which is, I think, a great way to look at it, by the way. We should care what Bronny wants and all this. The real question here might be, is it over in the sense that will they blow it up before next season? I mean, well, and I, look, we should really get to, we've got Everything Blacks has a question that ties into this, and so I'll cover that as well. It's, but to answer this element of it first, Pito, it's, you don't believe that they're going to blow it up unless they're moving Anthony Davis. They're not going to move LeBron James this summer, and like, even, I guess, is it beyond next year's last season, the last year for it, or next season, the last year for it? I think it's fair to wonder about that. This does sort of dovetail, though, with Everything Blacks asking. Well, let's get to the Lakers question first from Everything Blacks. I'm back with two Lakers questions. One, if the Lakers can't sign Kyrie this summer, do you see him as a possible Fred VanVleet destination? And two, do the Lakers at least consider trading AD this offseason? So let's get to the second one sort of first, where I think that, do you look at, I just don't, how do you get better by trading AD? Is it for Trae Young or Damian Lillard? And you think that makes you better because you have someone who operates from the point of attack? I don't think they do. I still think they view Anthony Davis as the potential lifeline or centerpiece for whatever rebuild, middle build that they attempt after LeBron leaves or retires or whatever. And I'm trying to think of the list of players that the Lakers specifically would trade AD for. And it's a matter of, okay, well, what would LeBron accept? And how does this actually make us better? Do you believe that you can approximate most of Anthony Davis's defensive value? Because, yeah, I guess you could approximate a lot of what he does on offense. How much of his defensive value can you approximate on the cheap? Or are you going to break it up into multiple role players, and then you're still asking LeBron to be your best player and in his age 39 season? It's probably a fair question in the sense that, and I know this is an oversimplification of it, but like, the fact that LeBron needed to guard Jokic when Anthony Davis is on his team, I understand why they did it. Pull Anthony Davis away, that's where he's at his best. But there's something to that. And there's also something to, AD's not going to carry a team offensively. He is mostly a play finisher, which means that he needs to be set up for. When he has the mid-range jumper going, or when he could hit his threes and really work off the dribble and hit tough shots going towards the basket, yes. But that's not something he does consistently, and that's never been the strongest part of his game. And so I could see the level of frustration there being, we need someone who is more apt to do that. And so then you're looking at, there's not really bigs, a lot, there's not a ton of bigs that are going to do that. And then of the ones that can, how many of them are actually available? So you're looking at, well, do we get another point wing in here? Can we get a point guard? And so it's, if you got Damian Lillard or Trae Young, do you do that? If you're the Lakers, I mean, Trae Young is substantially younger than Anthony Davis, so maybe you consider that. Talk about weird spacing in Atlanta. If you had Capella, I know Murray shot the ball okay from three, but Capella, Murray, and AD in Atlanta would be, I wonder what that offense would look like, let's just say. Damian Lillard, I feel like he skews a little too old there, and I don't know why Portland in that situation. Yeah, Atlanta, you could talk yourself into saying maybe they want to be competitive while trading Trae Young. I don't know if it's going to be the same if with Damian Lillard if Portland ever gets to that point. Jaylen Brown, like, is that someone that you would, he brings more creation, not a ton of passing. He was kind of all, he's been kind of all over the place in this Heat series. How much of that's his, I think he's dealing with an elbow injury. So yeah, that's, I don't think they'll consider trading AD. So I'm trying to think, it's not going to be for Kyrie either. That would be wild shit. AD and Luka could work, but if you wind up and you're the Mavericks and you gave up what you did to get Kyrie and then you flip him into Anthony Davis, man, that's something. But this also gets to the first part of this question from Everything Blacks. If the Lakers can't sign Kyrie this summer, do you see him as a possible Fred VanVleet destination? Now, the thing with the Lakers signing Kyrie, they can get to, if they keep Austin Reeves' cap hold, LeBron and AD, Like they can maybe get to around $30 million in room. Kyrie's max is 46.9. You can go the sign and trade route, and in theory, they could get to that money where if the Mavs are willing to take Malik Beasley's team option, and then is there, you know, a sign and trade with Rui Hachimura, but then there also might need to be a sign and trade with D'Angelo Russell involved as well, because $46.9 million is a monster number. Let's say you want to go, and look, the sign and trade rules get difficult because of the way that salary averages out. With D'Angelo Russell, it won't be as much of a problem. With Rui, though, because the pay increase is so substantial, probably, it might be. But let's just say you do a dual sign and trade of D'Lo and Rui Hachimura for Kyrie. You're still kind of limited to what you can offer him because you're hard capped after that. And next year's hard cap is going to be, I don't think that they've like specifically hammered it out just yet, but it's normally like a certain amount above the tax line. And so let's say 169 million, because the tax line is at 162. So let's say 169 million. You already have bonkers money committed to LeBron and AD. And I'm talking, it's over $87 million. It is 46.7 to LeBron, assuming he doesn't retire, which we are, and 40.6 for Davis. So 87.3. Kyrie's max alone, if you were to give him 46.9, you're at 134.2. And the hard cap, that is the cap. That is the salary cap, is $134 million. So you would need to flesh out your rest of your roster with basically minimums in that scenario. Like you're not, you know, would you technically have an exception to still use? Maybe. And can you squeeze that under? It's just, it's unrealistic. And then you also need Dallas to be interested in what you're sending back as well. And so to have those three on your payroll at the money they're probably going to command, and then still operate under the hard cap of 169 million, I guess in theory you could. That's just, whew. So long story short is, if you could get a Gary Trent Jr. or Fred VanVleet or both for some reason, I'd probably like that destination. The issue you run into is you need Toronto to be interested in what you're sending back. Now, you can trade after the fact the number 17 pick, and you have a 2029 pick or 2030 pick. And you can then, there are some swaps that you can include in there. Just what is the matching money that's going out? Are they going to want Rui and Malik Beasley in a sign? Like you, Malik Beasley's expiring contract, and then Rui Hachimura sign and trade to match whatever VanVleet is making? They have to want that, or they have to want D'Angelo Russell. And I think that's where it gets really difficult. Maybe, I guess maybe it's feasible if you're the Raptors and you're trading VanVleet, maybe you're fine with getting Rui Hachimura and Malik Beasley, and knowing Malik Beasley's entering the final year of his deal. But you need them to like that package. I do love the fit of Fred VanVleet. I don't know if he's, you know, I think he's fine on a team with LeBron James, where LeBron is still going to be the primary offensive organizer. But if you want him, that's why I kind of like VanVleet in Washington. But if you want him, someone to kind of be the tip of the entire spear, I don't know if he's that dude. He's someone who fits next really well next to that dude. But yes, it's feasible to get Fred VanVleet on the sign and trade. Unless Kyrie's taking a pay cut, it's probably more plausible than the Kyrie scenario. Although Kyrie gets cranky when you talk about his future. I don't know if anyone saw that IG live. So, but yeah, I like the idea of VanVleet to the Lakers. I just question, if you're the Lakers, do you want to give up the number 17 pick to make that happen? Because Toronto, VanVleet says he's going to leave anyway. Like maybe that's salary stuff. Rui Hachimura, Beasley, and number 17. Does that do it for you? Do you need that other first round pick that they could trade out? And at that point, I'm thinking twice if I'm the Lakers. I thought about Gary Trent Jr. for them, where you might be able to do it with just Malik Beasley's salary and then the 17th pick, depending on how much Gary Trent Jr. is making in his next deal. And I think that's someone who takes a lot of gambles on defense, but he can disrupt and then really just gets his 3-point volume up. Probably shouldn't give you as much ball handling because he's nowhere near the passer that Fred VanVleet is. You can get VanVleet, of course, but I'm looking at ways to where it's, all right, you know, the roster is seriously top heavy at that point. And do you need to allocate so much of your assets to one, to your top three players? And yeah, you still have Austin Reeves in that scenario, but you render D'Angelo Russell kind of meaningless. Like, do you want D'Angelo Russell and Fred VanVleet on the same team? Or are you willing to pay them if you could work that under the hard cap? I guess maybe, if you think D'Lo's coming off the bench. Food for thought there, though. Let's go to Everything Black said another one for the Toronto Raptors, asking, I'm already over 50 minutes here, awesome. Is it a little disconcerting that the that the Raptors, is it a little disconcerting that the Raptors fired Nick Nurse without a replacement lined up? Or maybe they did, read the room, and realized they would have to answer a few too many uncomfortable questions had they hired Ime Udoka, and now they seemingly don't know what they want in their next coach? Or should we view embarking on a wide search and interviewing as many candidates as possible, including some surprise names, in a positive light? That's a great question, because I think that this is very much, okay, like, you don't make this move that you did unless you have a person in mind. The Raptors have had, they've been linked to, I think Becky Hammon came out and took her name out, but they were linked to her at the beginning. Kenny Atkinson, Adrian Griffin, Charles Lee, assistant with Milwaukee, Kevin Young, the Phoenix Suns assistant. He's up for the Suns gig as well. Mitch Johnson from San Antonio, Jordan Fernandez, Chris Quinn from Miami. They were, I think this was from Michael Grange. They were also linked to Sam Cassell, Jerry Stackhouse, David Adelman. Like, those were names to keep an eye on. We know J.J. Redick and Steve Nash interviewed with them. And as Stein pointed out, J.J. Redick and Nash are the only people we know interviewed with the Raptors that have an interview with everybody else. And he did report, I believe, basically that the Raptors know who they want to be their next head coach. So are they waiting for someone else to blow them away? Or are they kind of waiting to see what happens with Tyronn Lue in L.A.? I don't know. I will view it as holding this wide of a search as mostly encouraging. Let's see on the decision that they ultimately make, but it does seem like they're doing their due diligence, and that this could be more of a situation of, well, it was time for a change regardless, and we had so-and-so in mind. Maybe it was Udoka and they backed away, and or he decided to go with the Rockets because he thought there might be more job security there, more leeway, just because of how early they are into the rebuild. Or he knows that James Harden, another star, is coming. Who the heck knows there? I'm going to choose to view it as encouraging for right now, but you don't want to see this drag out too long, especially with the draft coming up. We know that Masai Ujiri has a good infrastructure in place where they can navigate that anyway, but it's not like, you know, you want to have your head coach settled. They're just like you, the Wizards want to have their front office settled by the draft. So I'm going to choose to view it as encouraging. I get why it's disconcerting, though, because I think that it's, you know, like, so many names is almost just like, oh, are they kind of trying to throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks? I think, wasn't it, was Grains the one who also mentioned Dwayne Casey them, which is like, all right, what are we doing here? It's not on the level of Doc Rivers kind of shoehorning his way into discussions, though. He was mentioned to the Suns gig. I don't know how, it doesn't seem like that was super real, but I'm gonna view the wide search as encouraging, because the Raptors don't seem like a performative organization when it comes to this stuff, where it's like, we can say that other teams said, oh, look, we cast this wide of a net, but they just went with the guy you always knew that they were going to go with anyway. Everything Blacks has another question. This one is about the Blazers. Who do the Blazers have to fetch in return for the number three pick to make it worth their while? Some of the players they rumored to be interested in don't really move the needle, and the one player that does, Mikal Bridges, doesn't appear to be available. Yeah, look, it needs to be I think Mikal Bridges is probably the worst player, I would say, that you could acquire. And with a number three pick as that being the primary bait and him being the primary return and saying, okay, this is a success. Names, Jaylen Brown specifically. I think I might be in the minority on this, but if it's Brandon Ingram, if that's a name that becomes available, it's not a Zach LaVine, Bradley Beal situation and like sort of bolstering this backcourt. Other names here, like, I guess would you give it up if Paul George or Kawhi became available? I don't know if you would. That's really tough because of their injury history. Like, that might be, we're always a step behind. Like, there are players that we're not talking about right now that are going to become available. I think the ones that I have circled where, okay, their names aren't necessarily being mentioned right now, but could they feasibly hit the open market? I look at Pascal Siakam in Toronto, Jaylen Brown with Boston. I don't expect him to, since he's been super max eligible, but maybe the end of the playoffs will leave such a bad taste in his mouth. And then perhaps a Brandon Ingram, or as a long shot, Mikal Bridges, if the Nets think that they can actually get the third pick. Like, those are the types of names you need to get. And I would say that Mikal Bridges, if you're going to package this, because it's going to probably, for the most part, maybe Mikal Bridges number three straight up. Is that something the Nets consider with other salary machinations in there? Is that like, that's probably the worst player that I would say, okay, go ahead and like make the trade for the number three pick. And so you need that type of value, unless there's like, you know, is there a youngster that we're not talking about that's maybe still on his rookie scale that we could see becoming available? Would you give up the number three pick for Devin Vassell? let's say. I think most people would say no if they think he's, you know, maybe more of a supercharged Chris Middleton. But like, it's tough to spot those names. You could say, do the Hornets cut bait with LaMelo Ball? But why would Portland be interested in him when they already have Damon? They could work together. I just don't. That's not a super intuitive fit for a team that would be. Yeah, it's just not a super intuitive. Like, but you could name Trae Young might be worth the third pick, but that just doesn't make sense to pair him with Damian Lillard, for instance. And so, yeah, I think all the players I named, like, that's because you're not going to be in the Bradley Beal, the Zach LaVine business. And I think most people would argue neither of those guys is something they want to give up the third overall pick for. Excuse me. I'm trying to like think of younger guys right now that would be like, oh, like they're still being moved on their rookie scale. That's sort of interesting. Would you give that number three pick for Lauri Markkanen after the season he just had? I'd probably say no. I probably wouldn't do that for Lauri Markkanen. No, but if you're Utah and that was on the table, that's something you would certainly have to think about. Joel Embiid would be one. We just mentioned, I can't believe I didn't even mention that with the Sixers when we were just talking about the other question from Drizzy Watts. Was that the Drizzy Watts question? I apologize. Yeah. So Joel Embiid, like, that's certainly worth a discussion. Is this a situation where you try and like parlay it into multiple players where it's OG Anunoby and Gary Trent and then the Raptors lottery pick? Do you consider something like that? I don't even know if the Raptors would consider something like that. And the money going out is difficult. But let's just say GTJ, OG, and the Raptors have number 13 for number three. Like, you could probably swing something like that, and that would seem fairly reasonable. That's basically where I'm at, though, with the Blazers pick. And I will say that is why, though, because of how difficult it is, I don't default to them just moving it. They can say that they'll look for it, but that just feels like more of a cover, because moving the number three pick is really hard. Like, it's really hard. We're going to stick with Portland kind of for this next one. It's Alan asking, what do you think of a Brown sign and trade? What are your thoughts on a sign and trade for Brown and sending him out to Portland for Dame? Boston might need a first as well. Oh, they said I talked about this already on the last podcast. Well, let's talk about it again very quickly. They can't extend and trade Brown. Boston can't do that. Like, they can't supermax him and then flip him for a year. So you would have to just basically, you would send him to Portland as part of a trade. They would have to keep him in free agency because he's not supermax eligible on Portland. And then if you trade him on the supermax, you have to wait, I think it's 12 months. So would I give up the number three pick for Jaylen Brown, though, if he's guaranteeing to re-sign in Portland? I probably would. Like, does anyone else need to send out more in that scenario? I think you might argue that Portland needs to send out more there. It's whatever you feel about Jaylen Brown. Like, that's, he made second team All-NBA this year. We've seen Julius Randle make second team All-NBA, so read into it what you will, but we know this is someone who has impacted the game at both ends at the highest levels repeatedly. So whatever you thought about him being inconsistent, his passing has certainly not progressed the way that, there hasn't been that mega leap. And I think we've seen incremental improvement for the most part year by year from Jason Tatum. He does have more turnovers than assists, or at least he did leading into game. What was it, four? I think it was. Yeah. Cause they stayed off elimination. But Jaylen Brown's more apt to have those types of splits. I'd still give up the number three pick for him. I answered that question twice, apparently, Talon. Thank you for listening to the podcast. And then, you know, making an addendum to your question. I really do appreciate that, or noting that it doesn't need to be answered. This might actually be the last of yours that I actually have in here, but is Doc Rivers getting a job? I don't think he's coaching the NBA next season, and that'll be the first time he's not been employed. Let me look at this, actually, that he's not been employed since like is it the 90s? Let's see. So he was with Orlando in 99, 2000. I don't see any full years off there. He was fired in the middle of the season once in 2003, 2004. There was only 11 games. So if you want to count that, but I'm pretty sure every year since 99 and 2000, Doc Rivers has been a head coach. That is actually wild. That is wild. So we're talking about 24 years. I think it's going to be the first time he gets a break. If not, it'll be his permanent break. Will we see him in a booth somewhere? I know he was linked to Phoenix. That felt like kind of a reporter doing his agent a solid, but I will be floored. I mean, he's been employed for 24 years and people seem to really like him around the league, but no, I do not think Doc Rivers is getting a job, at least for next season. And this one comes from, this is a good one. I remember thinking about this one when you dropped it in Discord, Kilhoss. is considering the Mavs have the number 10 pick in cap space, would they be in a better position if Kyrie walked instead of re-signing? I like where your head's at here. The answer to me would be no, just because your cap space without Kyrie Irving is not all that much. If you just wipe his, you know, cap hold from the books, which his cap hold is at $46.9 million. So it is his max. You're still dealing with, like, I'll be conservative here and say under $20 million in room. You could get to more if you waive Reggie Bullock. That's, by the way, you're announcing Christian Wood. You're announcing Dwight Powell. Just because with Kyrie Irving's money on the books and their necessary holds, I have them at about $162 million in team salary. The cap is 134. And so if they're at, let's round up to 163, and we'll just subtract Kyrie Irving's number from that. You're going to have to add in a minimum. So 116.1, let's throw $2 million just in for a minimum hold. So you're at 118. You're under $20 million in cap space. So no, I don't think you're better off if he walks. Are you better off if you're able to sign and trade him somewhere, like to the Wizards for picks and maybe some of their, you know, is there a Kyle Kuzma sign and trade in there? Or are you getting Denny Avdia back? You're getting this year's. I don't think you're getting, if you got number 8 from them, I think you should probably pounce on it. That's probably a more fair question. You're best off by re-signing Kyrie Irving, though. I think that's where you're going to be in the best position by far, almost. I think the only case is, what can you get in a sign and trade for Kyrie Irving? And if it's just the Lakers package, let's just say you're able to work it. I mean, you're getting mostly footnotes, like, unless you're really high on Rui Hachimura, and like that's the machinations of it's Beasley and or it's a D'Lo and Hachimura double sign and trade plus, you know, the Lakers 2029 first for, and maybe number 17. So if you're getting number 17 and 2029 for Kyrie, I guess you could argue that you're better off in that scenario. I'm just wondering, do you have enough horses, or that's a terrible way to say it, I apologize, horsepower, asset horsepower, whatever, asset fuel to get OG Anunoby while re-signing Kyrie? And that's basically number 17, your 2027 first round pick. It would have to be conditional at that point. Does that get you OG like that in salary filler? I don't know. And if it doesn't, like, oh, okay, wow, you're in kind of trouble. And I don't know what the market is for Kyrie Irving sign and trade. So letting him walk specifically, I don't think you're better off. I mean, unless you want to go the tanking route, but that's just impossible to do for so many reasons with Luka Doncic there. You know, like, just going through the teams, what are teams that we could talk ourselves into saying, would they like consider bringing in Kyrie? Maybe the Clippers, but they can't do signing. The hard capping is so tough with them. They would have to dump salary after salary. But if you could get Paul George or even Kawhi, of course, that gets interesting. We already went over the LA one. Miami, they'd be hard pressed to work under the hard cap. They can send you a bunch of picks and maybe Tyler Hero. Milwaukee, if you get Drew Holiday and the one first round pick that they could trade this summer and Marjon Beauchamp, do you think that you're better off in that? They're also a team, though, working under the hard cap is impossible for them. So no, we gotta rule them out there. The Pelicans, like, no, that's not gonna be whatever. The Magic aren't just gonna up and decide to acquire Kyrie. The Phoenix stuff has subsided. We're now in the James Harden to Phoenix news cycle to join that. That's just not a realistic scenario. And then you're kind of out of it. Like, is Toronto going to decide to get involved here? I could see Washington would just be the wild card, where it's, hey, Kuzma, Avdia, picks. I don't think it would be number 8. It would be conditional picks into the future. You have Daniel Gafford too, Monte Morris, DeLon Wright. Like, there are a bunch of different workable pieces. So you nail Porzingis and Beal down to the floor, keep number 8 and say, okay, like, can we work out something here? That might be a way for them to get better. I don't think that, I do not think, though, that you're better just by letting him walk. And I've already gone so long that I will give you this one, Pito, as well. I think I answered a bunch of your questions, so hopefully you like that. Who would be more effective negatively between Şengün and Jalen Green if Harden eventually signs in Houston? I think it's pretty clearly Jalen Green, just because he seems, maybe not, because he could play off the ball as well. Yeah, I don't know, because the Jalen Green and James Harden backcourt defensively, like, how much is that staying on the floor? You could be targeted so easily, but I think you then could argue that the backline help is super important, or backline protection with both of them on the court. So Şengün's going to be more impacted. I do ultimately think Jalen Green needs the ball in his hands. Like, we've seen James Harden work with ball dominant guys before. I'm going to say Şengün, but then he could be a play finisher as well. Damn, this is. Whose development would be stunted more with James Harden on the Rockets? I'm going to say Şengün for this reason, because I think he then risked getting pigeonholed even more than he was under Steven Silas, where you're not going to get a lot of on-ball touches and chances to direct the offense anyway. Like, this isn't Joel Embiid where you're going to dump the ball off to him. You're still going to find touches, whether it's, oh, he's leading bench units, or we just saw it with James Harden and Chris Paul specifically, or James Harden during his short stint in Brooklyn. You will find a way to get other advantage creators or scorers touches. And Şengün is not that traditional guy. And because he might be able to work well off others, they're going to turn him into more of just a screen setting pick and pop big, or someone who just needs to constantly play off of Jalen Green and James Harden because they're both there, rather than developing him and give like, a lot of, like we've seen a lot with DeAndre Ayton in Phoenix for the most part, even before the Kevin Durant trade. And then lo and behold, you go and test out his on-ball skills, different player than Şengün, want to make that clear, but like, he just doesn't have him. But think of the DeAndre Ayton role. The reason he was playing that for the most part was because the Suns didn't have the runway to plumb the depths of his offensive game. And then they go and do it. It's okay. We shouldn't have done it in the first place. Şengün's a little bit different, whereas I still think that would happen to him. It's just that he would be capable of more. That does it for me. After saying I was going to go for 45 minutes, I went for 70 plus. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, download wherever you consume us. Like, subscribe on YouTube as well. Comment, help the algorithm love us back. Join our Discord. The link to that is in the podcast and YouTube description. And finally, and I'll move the screen down, we've got merch. So go check out the merch that we've got going on to support the show that way as well. Link is in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Until next time, and as always, I leave you with the shout out to the one, the only, the indelible Frank. I'm posting hype videos on IG all offseason, apparently.